Its reactions can come into operation on the very same day that an act is performed, or the same year, or the same birth, without waiting for a future embodiment. The relation between an evil deed and its inevitable retributory consequences is a sure one, but the time when it manifests itself is obscure and must necessarily vary with each individual. Nevertheless, this doctrine does not imply that our sufferings without exceptions are merited. For humanity is so interlinked that we cannot always escape the effects of the evil acts performed by others with whom we are thrown in contact, even though the misfortune thereby wrought is not our due. But in that case, we may rest assured that the compensatory working of karma will eventually bring into play some good fortune which would not otherwise have been ours. Karma therefore does not doom us to complete fatalism. It is only a part of life. The element of freedom is likewise present. There is no absolute freedom in life, but then there is no absolute fatalism either. Karma makes us personally responsible for our thoughts and deeds. We cannot shift the blame for wrongdoing onto the shoulders of another, whether he be man or God. We take up our old tendencies with each new birth in this frail tenement of flesh, renew great loves and grand friendships, face afresh the problem of old enmities, suffer or enjoy our proper deserts, and drink from the cup of life's experience until we are satiated. But satiety forces reflection, and this in turn brings wisdom. When we have moved up and down the ladder from ragged beggar to bejeweled king, we learn at last how to handle the contrasting situations of human existence correctly. When we have been tempted, tantalized and disillusioned, when we have burnt our fingers because of wrongdoing or been benefited by well-doing, we understand finally the best way to conduct ourselves in all dealings with others. We are all the products of our unseen past experience and our unremembered past thinking, that is of time, and are not to be blamed for being what we are. We cannot help that, but we are to blame for not trying to be better. Time is thus the supreme teacher. No mortal can give us the lessons it places before our eyes. It brings all the wealth of varied experience. It assuages errors into wisdom, pain into peace, disappointment into discipline, and hatred into goodwill. Time will turn better pages for us than those in books, and speak more sagely than the lips of men. It teaches us to learn from our weaknesses, not to weep over them. It is an error to put karma on the moral plane only. It also operates epilogue, the philosophic life, on the intellectual plane. Thus a good man's feebler intelligence pitted against an evil man's superior intelligence may bring the former loss and even suffering for a time, even though he is morally better. For he has to learn to build a balanced personality, and not merely a lopsided one. Moreover, pious persons who suffer from an excess of sentimentality do not understand that charity only becomes a virtue when it is done at the right time to the right person, and that it is nothing less than a vice when it is misplaced or mistimed. Karma provides us with the assurance that no efforts are wasted. Whether in this birth or in a later, we shall enjoy their just consequences. Where heredity fails to explain why a clever son should be born to foolish parents, karma steps in and smooths the problem. We inherit physical characteristics from our parents, but mental characteristics from our previous personality on earth. This explains why there are children who are old for their age and adults who are children for their age. It puts order and justice where formerly chaos and cruelty alone reigned. Those who reject karma reject what is patent all around them. Their own lives are unalterably predetermined to a certain extent, do what they will. The good or bad family into which they were born, the wealth or poverty they have inherited, the white or black skin they possess, all these are matters in which they have been powerless to choose, and wherein they have been but the unconsulted recipients of the awards of karma. To a limited extent, therefore, but no more, karma forges a steel ring around every man. Others who raise the ancient bogey that where there is any remembrance of past lives there can be no benefit from present pleasure or pain arising out of them overlook two points. The first is the very constitution of the mind itself, which presents the double faces of the unconscious and the conscious to our gaze. The merest initiation into psychology is an initiation into this undoubted fact. how much of present experience has already disappeared into the storehouse of the unconscious. The second point is that they cannot have the memory of one previous embodiment without having the memories of all the thousands which preceded it. But who could endure such an opening of the bound volumes of human experience for even a single day? Who could take in all that cinematograph film of a myriad bestial horrors and a myriad primitive joys that are now no longer joys? The upshot of such an experience would be a complete lapse into madness. Rather should we be thankful to nature for this gift of forgetfulness as we should be thankful to her for the gift of sleep. For if we had not received it, we should be totally unable to concentrate upon the present life at all. Karma, properly understood, never kills initiative but positively promotes it. What we do now will actively contribute to the making of our future, no matter what we have done in the forgotten or remembered past. Therefore, there is always some degree of hope for everyone. We are simultaneously the hapless creatures of our past and the hopeful creators of our future. What men do not comprehend about fate is that although certain events of life are more or less predetermined by karma at birth, still they can sometimes be changed to some extent by changing character. For character is the seed, the root, of all fate. If we have to endure certain limitations imposed by destiny, we have also got certain freedom to work within those limitations. It is the art of right living to reconcile both factors and adjust them sensibly. Here it may be well to observe that the Indian teaching adds that the last thoughts of a dying man will conjoin with his general and subconscious tendencies to determine the characteristics which will take a foothold in his next embodiment. It would be well, therefore, if this were better known and more widely utilized. For thus we may more readily meet again those we love, thus we may mentally picture and obtain a particular field of desired service, and thus the disciple ties himself more closely to his teacher. There are times to fight fate and times to endure it. When the latter periods come, it is wise to apply the Chinese technique of handling a cycle of misfortune as expounded in their ancient classic texts. This is based on the principle of adapting oneself to the cycle by conforming patiently and voluntarily to its restrictions and anticipating them in self-restraint. Just watch a juggler catch falling eggs on porcelain plates without breaking egg or plate. How does he do it? When the moment of meeting between egg and plate occurs, he gives the slight downward movement to the latter. The speed of this movement coincides with the speed of the fall of the egg and thus reduces the shock of contact. Or observe the technique of expert boxers. When one launches a hard blow at the other, the latter will sometimes make a backward motion as though apparently yielding to the blow. Were he to move forward to meet the attack, the force of impact would naturally be greater, just as the combined velocities of two trains approaching each other is greater than that of any single train. The boxer who yields by slightly retreating lessens the force of the blow which he receives. In the same way, we should meet the blows of karma by flexibly adapting epilogue, the philosophic life, ourselves to the inevitable, by not attempting new enterprises during a dark cycle, for instance. Here again we can call in the confirmation of science. Quantum theory and uncertainty principle have shed startling new light on physics. The old views of science were favorable to faith in the notion of karma, the new views are favorable to faith in the notion of free will. The old views were based on a world structure which was clasped in the iron clutches of physical law. Determinism and necessitarianism were inevitable outlooks in such a universe. The new science has passed beyond this cold-blooded rigidity and has penetrated into the strange spontaneity of subatomic life. Its discovery completes the circle. The truth is that the universe has freedom at its heart but fate at its circumference, and that man consequently is a creature of both influences. The practical lesson is, change the prevailing tenor of your thoughts and you will help to change, in time, the prevailing condition of your affairs. Correct your mental and ethical errors and the correction will ultimately tend to become apparent in better character and improved environment. To a considerable extent, man builds and changes his environment, constructs the history of his life and shapes his own circumstances by the simple power of mind, for destiny is ultimately self-earned and mind-made. Karma shows how this can be so, and the doctrine of mentalism shows why this must be so. Lastly, we must learn through yoga practice and philosophic reflection the art of being unruffled. For troubles must come, but as they come, so will they go. The same power that brought them will also take them away. Fortune is a turning wheel. Meanwhile, the mind should remain firmly anchored where it belongs, in truth, not in illusion. Although karma is really a scientific law, it was appropriated by the Asiatic religions as well as by the pagan faiths of primitive Europe. But for an apparent accident of history, it might also have been an item among the tenets of modern Christianity, for it lived in Christian faith for 500 years after Jesus. Then a group of men, the Council of Constantinople, banished it from the Christian teaching, not because it offended the ethics of Jesus. What could be nobler than its perfect harmony with the Master's own statement, "Whatsoever ye sow, that shall ye also reap"? Nor because it offended the integrity of Christianity. Where is there a clearer advocacy of it than in the writings of the great Christian patriarch Origen? But because it offended their own petty personal prejudices. Thus a little band of foolish men sitting near the shores of the Sea of Marmara so late as 550 years after the appearance of Jesus have been permitted to banish a Christian tenet which did not suit their own cast of temperament. Thus they have robbed the West of a religious belief which, in the turn of history's wheel, must now be restored to the modern world for the scientific truth that it really is. It is the duty of those who rule nations, guide thought, influence education and lead religion to make this restoration. Truth demands it in any case, but the safety and survival of Western civilization imperiously demand it still more. When men learn that they cannot escape the consequences of what they are and what they do, they will be more careful in conduct and more cautious in thinking. When they comprehend that hatred is a sharp boomerang which not only hurts the hated but also the hater, they will hesitate twice and thrice before yielding to this worst of all human sins. When they understand that their life in this universe is intended to be an evolutionary process of gradual growth and understanding, they will begin to assess their physical, moral and mental values aright. A sound ethical life will follow naturally as a function of such understanding. The West has great and quick need for the acceptance of karma and rebirth because they make men and nations ethically self-responsible as no irrational or incoherent dogma can make them. Modern scientific knowledge can easily fit these doctrines into its framework of reference, provided they are properly presented, because they alone explain neatly how the simple-minded Hottentot evolves into the subtle-minded Hegel. We live in a shrieking Tower of Babel. Nearly everyone has something to say, says it at the top of his voice, and yet for all this shouting, few succeed in saying anything that is worthwhile, for few tell us why we are here on earth at all. Hence, the urgency of popularizing the karma doctrine, the welfare of the world. We have so far treated karma from the scientific and practical standpoint. What the hidden philosophy has to say about it puts an entirely different aspect on the matter, but that is a reserved subject too. We have indeed forgotten the philosopher for the moment to remember the more urgent needs of the Right Reverend Sigurjir Sigurdsson, Bishop of Iceland and a personal friend of the author, has courageously made this experiment. The result has been remarkably successful among the younger generation, who have responded energetically. Epilogue: The philosophic life, the unphilosophic masses who have been touched by the questioning ferment of our time. It may be said, however, that as our studies in mentalism have revealed that the primal substance of this world is thought and that matter is nothing other than mind, so we must concede to mind in actuality and universality a permanence with which we normally refuse to endow it. And we must further concede that because man's whole life and activity are purely mental, his thoughts may vanish into the depths of the unconscious and yet not be lost. For mind is incessantly generating its constructions anew, unhindered by limitations of time and space, because the latter are also its own constructions. Hence, the individual streams of ideas may reappear again or react on each other across long lapses of time and great acres of space. Thus the doctrine of karma can find a mentalistic justification. The philosopher, however, finds a still higher basis than karma for lofty and unselfish personal and social ethics when he finds truth and reality. to understand this, we must anticipate advanced studies and consider for a moment that the ecstatic peace which comes to the artist during his creative moments is not dissimilar from that which comes to the mystic. It has been pointed out that this is mostly due to their temporary release from the ego. The eye carries a great burden, be it one of ulcerous worries or gay pleasures. Few know that forgetting oneself is the key to a larger happiness. In philosophy, after all the facts have been ascertained and verified, this ideal is set up as one of its rational conclusions. It is then also found that there is a secret thread running from man to man, from creature to creature, and that the hidden constitution of the world is so unified that whoever believes he can assure his own happiness and welfare regardless of what happens to others is forever fated to be bitterly disillusioned. So long as the chasm which separates the I and the you remains as wide and as deep as it is, so long will I and you be foredoomed to suffer. Moreover, one of the philosophical implications of the principle of relativity is that no single thing in the whole universe stands isolated from anything else. No single thing exists in its own right. A web of interrelatedness stretches right across the world. Even the interdependence of modern society, with its economic, political and social reactions from one corner of the world to another, is alone enough to hint at this. There is hardly a half-educated man in any country of the globe who is not more familiar with international affairs than was the average educated man prior to. Such is the growing awareness of this interdependence. Why the hidden stretching beyond yoga or philosophy preaches self-control and advocates service of humanity, not because these might be good for the other man alone or good for the philosopher alone, but because it is good for both. Its view of man is a view of society as a whole. Hence it teaches and proves that no individual man can attain other than illusory happiness so long as his fellows are unhappy. The old notion that a philosopher is impervious to current events must go. He is interested in them because he is interested in the welfare of his fellow men. But he will not permit them to swamp his judgment or menace his peace, for amid all else he holds to philosophic calm and impartial reason. Whoever finds the high privilege of this wisdom conferred upon him will automatically find that it comes like a double-edged sword, the new privilege upon one side but a new responsibility upon the other, for the lofty knowledge which he has attained enjoins upon him that he shall henceforth practice the highest of all ethics. In discovering the final unity of all things and creatures, in being born again, as Jesus put it, in realizing that the over-self of which he is now aware is likewise the over-self of all other living beings, he has no alternative but to perceive that the welfare of the world is equivalent to his own welfare. The service of the all will henceforth replace in his heart the service of the individual ego. His acts must not only satisfy his own self but also be beneficial to others. They must always try to perform this twofold function. It is for this reason that a real sage is not a hibernating hermit. Such a sage makes the discovery that the golden rule of doing unto others what we would have them do unto ourselves is uncommon sense made common. No religion has ever taught a higher ethic than this, and no experience can ever suggest a more sensible one. No other maxim for the conduct of life than this simple maxim of Jesus and Krishna, Confucius and Buddha, will help a man more to travel smoothly and unhindered along the stone-scattered highways of existence. It is a rule which works wonders, and which can be universally applied to all men in all stations of life and at all times. It is as good with brown-skinned Orientals as with white-skinned Occidentals, as satisfactory with ragged outcasts as with well-fed millionaires, and its value is out of all proportion to its simplicity. For we are all children of the one infinite life, members of the same vast human family. Let us therefore do the considerate, the generous. This invented term is here introduced and will be frequently used later because it has already become familiar to readers of the author's other works. It is intended to signify the ultimate reality of both man and the universe. Epilogue, the philosophic life and the compassionate deed whenever possible in preference to the mean, the selfish and the cruel one, if we would have karma deal kindly with us. If it be asked why should a man trouble to learn or define truth if he is already practicing goodwill to all beings, the reply is, because, first, He will not know that it is truth and may therefore change his mind tomorrow, and so give up his good will. It will be based on feelings, which are admittedly volatile. And, second, human affairs are notoriously complex, and right and wrong are often curiously intermingled. And, third, philosophy offers the only warrant for an ethical and selfless life which is based wholly on reason and yet does not lead to selfishness or wickedness. When the Buddha, therefore, inculcated compassion, it was not on the basis of mere sentiment but on that of profound knowledge. The man who left loving wife and marble palace in quest of intangibles like peace and truth was no sentimentalist. It would be a profound error, however, to suppose, as is usually supposed, that because Buddha also taught the doctrine of non-violence which Gandhi has made famous in modern times, he meant this for the practice of all men. He meant it only for monks and those ascetics who had renounced the worldly life with its responsibilities. Like all true sages, the Buddha recognized that there was no universal code of morality and that there were gradations in duty, stages in ethics. Hence when General Sima came to question him about this very point, torn by doubt whether he should give up his profession of soldiering or continue in it, the Buddha replied, "He who deserves punishment must be punished. Whosoever must be punished for the crimes he has committed suffers his injury not through the ill will of the judge but on account of his evil doing." The Buddha does not teach that those who go to war in righteous cause after having exhausted all means to preserve the peace are blameworthy. He must be blamed who is the cause of the war. The Buddha teaches a complete surrender of self, but he does not teach a surrender of anything to those powers that are evil. These words are quoted only because they express exactly the viewpoint of the hidden teaching upon the same question. It is not denied that the correct attitude for monk or mystic is to take no life under any circumstances, but rather to suffer his own, martyr-like, to be taken away instead, and to cause no hurt to any other person even in punishment. Gandhi, therefore, with his doctrine of non-violence, represents Indian mysticism at its best, but it would be a gross mistake to take him as a representative of the far higher, the hidden stretching beyond yoga Indian philosophy. The latter does not teach an ethic of emotional exaltation but an ethic of reasoned service. It is strong where the other is sentimental. The famous injunction of Jesus to resist not evil must also be interpreted in the same light. It is to be followed literally and externally by mystics and renunciants, but intelligently and internally by the wise. For although the latter have come to know their ultimate oneness with the crook and criminal, this need not prevent them from protecting themselves or others against crookedness and criminality or from punishing wrongdoers for their malpractices, provided, as Buddha further pointed out, this is done without hatred. For then, observed the great Asiatic teacher, the criminal should learn to consider that this punishment is the fruit of his own act, and as soon as he can honestly arrive at such understanding, the punishment will purify his soul and he may no longer lament his fate but actually rejoice in it. A mysticism which makes a man into a passive spectator of aggressive injustice or violent murder, or an asceticism which makes him condone evil done in his presence on the plea that he has renounced the world and its ways, does not represent the real wisdom of India. It is the duty of a philosopher not to refuse help when suffering victims cry out against attack, but to bestow it, using force if necessary. A doctrine that preaches lethargic inertia or flabby non-violence in the face of acts of flagrant violation of justice and goodwill is completely unacceptable to philosophy. Such misunderstanding of the old sages and such weakness of heart and mind have never helped India but merely degraded her. The mystic who is afraid of administering punishment because he is afraid of causing suffering is guided by emotion. The philosopher who is not afraid to do so when necessary knows that suffering is the greatest teacher of man, for what man will not learn by reason he must learn by pain. He who will not think must suffer. What he might learn in a few minutes through reflection will be whipped into him during a few years through pain. Many a blow falls on the head of a man just to get a single idea into it. He must learn by personal anguish what he has refused to learn by personal reflection. He must understand by bitter pain what he would not understand by the persuasions of philosophy. for the mystic wishes to be undisturbed and to disturb none, whereas the philosopher wishes to be altruistic and to serve all. Nevertheless, the philosopher helps humanity in his own way, not in theirs, for they know only what they desire, he what they epilogue, the philosophic life need. He helps wisely, which means that he is not a sentimentalist. Heart and head must justify each other. Finally, he prefers to go quietly to the fountainhead and help the few through whom he can help the many. Thus, he economizes time, resources and energy, and in the end achieves immeasurably more service than if he gave his whole time to individuals. In our frankest moments we discover that we have never been altruistic, but we have sought a subtle or obvious self-satisfaction in all our deeds. Unselfishness is unnatural. We all look at life through slash glasses. Why therefore should I do good to others? Is a natural and proper question to ask. Philosophy answers by saying, because secretly and ultimately all mankind forms one great family. Because the full consciousness of this fact is the grand goal of human evolution. Because life is far holier than pious people realize. Because that unknown reality which men in their remoteness call God, which we may better call the over-self, is both our own secret self and the world's secret self. He who has realized this unitary consciousness has simultaneously realized that it is the duty of the strong to assist the weak, of the advanced to help the backward, of the saintly to guide the sinful, of the wealthy to lighten the burden of the destitute, and of the wise to enlighten the ignorant. And because ignorance is the root of all other troubles, therefore the Buddha pointed out that explaining and spreading the truth is above all charities. Most of us have to work at something whether we like it or not and whether we are philosophers or not. Philosophy does not alter that, but it can alter the ultimate ends for which we are working. We can work to earn a mere livelihood or we can work to make a memorable life. For most people life consists of some pleasures but more burdens. Yet they think and act as though it consisted of some burdens but more pleasures. We must make men reflect upon the values they wish to obtain from life. Do they want to earn a livelihood? Do they want to enjoy themselves? Do they want the truth about the world's meaning and life's end? Yet they may have all these, for none are contradictory, provided always they learn to keep a sense of proportion, a proper equilibrium. Tremendous are the possibilities of an existence governed by the philosophic rule of a balanced life, actuated by the selfless desire to better one's corner of the world, dynamized by the pointed power of concentrated thought and guided by the full light of this new old East-West wisdom. Men with far less equipment have amazed the modern world with their achievements for good or evil. Are there a few the hidden stretching beyond yoga courageous enough to gamble their personal lives with destiny that they may enrich their age and bless others? Wise enough to give up this long littleness of the egoistic life whose ultimate end is but the cold grave? Can truth find a few friends to serve and support her with a wholly dedicated life? Who can put self strongly behind him and stretch out his hands far enough to grasp this great paradox? A philosophic view of the world crisis. If the call for men who are actuated by the will to help not only themselves but also mankind is forever sounding silently in the ears of those who understand the meaning of life, it is today sounding 100 times more strongly. For in no previous epoch of world history has such misery and such ignorance been so widespread. The need of world enlightenment is immensely greater today than in the centuries of Jesus and Buddha, those grand figures who walk through history in auroral splendor. For consider our own time. The modern epoch was the most delightful and withal the most miserable of any. It was sired by mammon, mothered by the misunderstanding of life's end and cradled in a comfortable automobile. It began with the cloud-high expectations and rosy promises of applied and inventive science, but has set low with disappointment and disillusion. It sinks in a dismal decrepitude of ideals. We went forward so breathlessly that we deluded ourselves with the sensation of rapid and all-round progress. Now that delusion has been exploded, a day of relentless reckoning has come to the world. For our progress was a one-sided affair. It was mainly technological, not teleological. When men crystallize their habits of thought, ways of living and general outlook along materialistic lines, they become unconscious of their ethical danger and of their waste of the precious opportunity of incarnation. Only a tremendous outside impact could shock them back into awareness of the futility and failure of such a life. Such an impact has been provided by the world crisis, with the two wars and the national nightmares which have been its spotlights. Karma is forever at work in the history of all nations and of all individuals.